Welcome to the Andrew D'Angelo podcast.
Constant Constance. Each week, Andrew, renowned jazz saxophonist and brain cancer survivor, invites us to look at the many worlds of his guests with conversations that cover all the arts, human resilience, a little bit of politics, and a lot of humour.
You can't fail to have a fantastic time.
Hey everyone, and welcome. We are here today with the most amazing pianist, composer, and I always say this, but improviser, because a lot of my guests and friends are amazing improvisers. And she also teaches at UC Berkeley, University of California, California Berkeley. And this is Myra Melford. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Myra. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. It's really great to be here.
And I when we were talking before, I told you I had this anecdote and that I wanted to tell. And it's a story about, and I know people on the show, I talk about my whole brain cancer thing. And I hope we get to hear about your own, your personal experience with health if you want to. And, but I had, after having the two brain surgeries, I really couldn't go on tour for about a year, maybe a year and a half. It just wasn't physically possible for me. I mean, I don't know if people know what it's like to be on the road, but it's what? It's arduous. Can we say that, Myra? It's like...
Definitely. Yeah. You have to be in good health to do it.
Right. So about a year, year and a half, so 2009 at some point, I finally went on tour in Europe. I know we played in Norway. I think we played in Amsterdam at the BIM House. And then we went to England. The tag gig, the end of the tour was I played with you and that, and you don't have to remember this. I'm not asking you to remember this. This is how you influenced me. We played at the Vortex. It was this British trumpet player, Chris Batchelor. I don't know if you remember this gig, right? And I believe Jim Black was playing drums and I'm just winging it. And anyway, at that time I had two suitcases, one for my clothes and stuff like that and outfits, and one for all like my pills, like herbs, and supplements, and vitamins and tinctures and blah, 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 and healing stuff. Anyway, the airline lost that bag, okay, which I never actually got back. Yeah. And I remember I was talking to you either during the set break or before, after the gig, I don't remember. And I was just going, oh my God, they lost all my stuff. And you looked at me, and I know you're not, you probably don't remember this, but you looked at me like you're looking at me right now, which is very intimidating, by the way, and also beautiful. And she, and you said, you said, well, that just means you don't need those things anymore. I was like, oh, no, because I was really obsessed. I mean, I literally was taking, I think at that point, like 30, maybe 35 different supplements and tinctures and things like, I mean, it was really very arduous what I was doing to myself. And you're like, yeah, it just means you don't need those things anymore. Anyway, that meant a lot to me. And I'm alive today. So it's not like you gave me bad advice, right?
Okay, good. I was worried.
No. My point is you were just like, Andrew, you don't really need to obsess about like all of that anymore. You're good. That's how I took it.
All right.
So if I had died, then maybe you could feel guilty. But since it's like, you know, a decade or more later, and I'm sitting here talking to you on this interview, I just wanted you to know that I really appreciate you saying that. And I don't know why it's stuck in my brain, but it's stuck in my brain.
Wow, that's amazing. I don't, and did you actually give up some of those supplements after that?
Oh yeah. I'm like, well, I can't take 300 pills a day. I can't, I mean, even if they're vitamins, it was just like this like ritual. I had a calendar. I had everything, you know, every day at certain times I would take this vitamin, that herb and that tincture. And then, you know, at a certain point, it's just like, all right, that's good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. It was just amazing. And you sounded brilliant on that gig. I don't remember anything else, but I don't remember Chris Batchelor's playing. I don't remember my playing. I don't remember Jim Black's playing. I didn't even know who was playing bass, but you sounded phenomenal as you always do. And you probably don't remember that gig, but
I do remember the gig. And I remember, I think it was Oren, oh my gosh, I'm spacing on his last name. Great tuba player.
Oh, right. Who the heck was that?
Band with Chris Batchelor and Jim and I. And
who was that guy? Who is that?
I want to say Marshall, but I don't really know if I'm getting his last name right. I have to look it up. But anyway, a phenomenal tuba player.
Yeah, he's really good. I have not heard of him or from him in years, but man, right. What? Oh, Oren, we're so sorry. But if you want to like reach out and make a comment or something, we don't remember your last name, man. Share your music, right? So what's going on? I know you said you're in Manhattan at this point right now, right? Excuse me.
Yeah, just for a couple of days. I actually have this friend I'm staying with. Her daughter just got married, and I've known her daughter since she was a baby. So I happened to be able to come over for the wedding. So that's what I did this weekend. But I'm actually living in Europe for most of the year. I'm on sabbatical this year from UC Berkeley.
So you're on sabbatical from UC Berkeley, and you said you had a residency or something in Rome. Tell us about that, right? Is that correct?
Not exactly. I don't have an official residency. I have a residence. Okay. A colleague of mine from UC Berkeley, who is from Pesaro, his name is Carmen Echella, has a house in Pesaro on the Adriatic. And nice. He's not living there right now. He's in Berkeley. So he said, and I told him I have this big project that I want to do that some of it I need to be in Italy for. So he said, oh, you can use my house.
Nice. You know. That's great.
But I do have a residency in Paris starting in January, which will take me through the second semester.
Okay. So, you know, I took this young filmmaker to Europe. It was, I guess, gosh, was that 2019? What year are we in, for God's sake? I have no idea with this pandemic. And it was his first time in Europe. And we went and filmed on the Adriatic Sea. And he was like, whoa. I mean, we weren't in the sea. We were on cliffs, you know, and like filming me playing saxophone. Doesn't matter. But he was like, why would anybody want to live anywhere else? And I was like, I don't know. He's like, this is so beautiful.
Do you remember where it was?
Oh, geez. I knew you were going to ask me that, Myra. I don't remember. No,
okay. That's okay.
I'm not one of your students. I don't remember. The story is, I remember this filmmaker who had never been to Europe. It's his first time. He's like in his late 30s, whatever. And here we are with this Italian film company filming over the Adriatic Sea. And he's like, whoa, like this is just like, what? You know, it's like the postcard. That's amazing that... But this is also very Italian, right? You take my house. It's no problem. It's very pretty. You can stay here. Right? Yeah. They're such good people, man.
Yes, totally. And his parents live nearby, and they've been incredibly kind and welcoming and helped me get set up and helped me find my way around. And all
they're like, here's some tomatoes and here's some pasta. And right? Yes. I mean, I think us Americans can learn not just from Italy, but from Europe in general. Sorry, just kicked my table. It's a little wobbly. But, right, there's just this incredible, I would just say kindness that Europeans have in general, especially the Italians. And they want to hug you. They give you a kiss, and not romantic kiss. Just like, hey, can we get you something? Can we help you? You know, it's so, right? It's just something that Americans, sorry, America, but we need to figure that shit out, man. Like, you know, love thy neighbor, as they say, right?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think it's especially true in Italy. Like Italian culture tends to be very warm and welcoming and generous. And I mean, yeah, totally. And also Europe in general just is a totally different vibe when it comes to lifestyle and sort of the whole work-life balance. That I think is really out of whack in the U.S.
Right. So like Europe's like, take a month off. We don't care. Right. Go for it. I have a friend from Norway who's on a sabbatical. Right. They're like, take a year off. Go do something. Right. Is that what it's like when you teach at UC Berkeley? Are they when you took your sabbatical? Did you have to go jump through a bunch of hoops, or were they like, we want you to go and advance yourself? I know at one point you and I were talking. Oh my gosh, this was years ago. And you were talking about something about juggling your professional life with your teaching life. But that's weird, right? Because your students must feel incredibly honored to have you as their teacher. I mean, you're so brilliant and your music is just like off the charts, amazing. And they get to interact with you. Like, never mind whatever teaching about the chromatic scale or harmony. You're just, hey, I get to like be with Myra Melford. That's amazing. But when you ask to do your sabbatical, is it difficult, or were they just like, do it?
You know, you have to wait until you've completed X number of semesters of teaching before you're eligible.
Right.
But once you are, then it's just a question of working it out with your colleagues so that not too many people are leaving at once. You know what I mean? And right. So the classes are still covered. So I decided actually to postpone my sabbatical for as long as I could to try to take a whole year off instead of just a semester. And I didn't wait until I actually had enough sabbatical credits. So I did have to apply for funding, a fellowship to cover my salary while I'm away. And so that was, you know, a process I had to go through, but fortunately I got it. And I feel like in general, the university is very supportive of people getting time off to do the work that you do, which is why they hired you in the first place, you know?
Right. It's funny. When you said university, I heard universe, and there's something about you. I believe that, and Myra, you can just be nice to me, but I think you're this very, I find you a very spiritual and very connected person. I do not want to make anybody or call anybody new age or anything like that, but I think you're very connected, that your music, and when I listen to your playing and the energy around it and to your compositions, did you write this music about the Sufi poet Rumi? Is that true, or is that a reviewer who said that?
No, it's true. Well, I mean, I wrote a bunch of pieces that were inspired by poetry by Rumi.
I have this. Do you know that book?
I don't know The Glance.
Right, Rumi. It's just one of those things where I open it up every now and then, and there's a poem, and then I read it, and I'm like, okay, that's my thing for today, right? Yeah. And I wish the font was bigger, Rumi. Well, whoever's putting this, oops, sorry, I hit my microphone, everybody. But it's like, it's really fun and inspirational, but I have to get like a magnifying glass out. So like literally, you know, I was checking out something on YouTube, and I wanted to watch you because I realized that when we've played together, it's not like we're sitting there looking at each other. So I was like, I'm going to watch Myra play, not just hear her play. Uh-huh. And super, super connected. What is it that are you connected to? Like, what does that even mean when somebody says that? I'm sorry for the question, but I don't know how else to ask it. I don't know what to.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate it because, you know, I think you're touching on what is sort of central to my aspiration as a musician. I think for me, it's about connecting into, energy. It's kind of a feeling, but it's not about emotion. It's a connection to, I guess I would call it like the Shakti or the Chi or the, you know, sort of the life force, the consciousness that's in everything.
Yeah.
Music.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then in by doing that, I'm hoping then that I'm offering that, an experience of that to people who hear or feel the music.
I got goosebumps when you were just talking because it's like some people like the Shakti, right, or Chi. Some people call it the source. Some people call it the universe. Some people call it the light. I mean, there's right. I'm sorry to obfuscate anything, but there is this energy that you have, and like especially there is one thing I was watching with Snowy Egret. Is that how you say Egret? I've heard it. Egret.
People I've heard it both ways. Yeah.
Right.
I usually just say Snowy Egret, but.
Right. And you were like dancing on the piano. I mean, you were using your arms and you were, I mean, anything but standing on it and pounding on the keys. And I'm curious, like, what is that? What are you doing there? Are you getting visions? Are you getting, is that just energy? Is that super, super meticulous? Like, I'm going to put my arm from D flat to C or whatever. I mean, I'm curious. I mean, I love it. I know people are curious.
Well, I mean, you know, it's, I'm not thinking, that's for sure.
Right. You're like in the zone, as they say, or something like that. Right.
But I'm being specific about the rhythm and about the range, but not the exact pitches. Usually, sometimes I am, but usually not very much. It's really more, and that kind of playing usually comes after some sort of buildup, you know, and I, then it's just like, this is just like what's happening. I'm just along for the ride.
Right. It's like a stream of consciousness in a way. Yeah. Is that fair enough to like really dumb it down for people like me who are
totally
don't want to, huh?
Yeah, totally. It is. It is stream of consciousness, and it's the most fun. Like, it's the best place to be because I don't have to think about what I'm doing. It's like, it's just happening. And all I have to do is let it happen, you know? But the other thing, yeah.
No, but that's why I love when you play with Matt Wilson, our friend who's a drummer.
Yeah.
Because I think people sometimes write Matt off as just like a humorist or like, you know, but Matt is also always in the moment. That's something I've always loved about him. Mm. And when you and Matt play together, and also Mark Dresser on bass, but I don't think Matt Wilson gets enough credit for being this guy who's super in the moment. And he doesn't do what you do when you're like just fucking going crazy on the piano, right? Just like making it your, I don't know, I could use a naughty word there, but you're just in the moment. And Matt gets lost in his drums and it's great. He's just not thinking, he's just having fun. And sure, sometimes it's funny and there's nothing wrong with that, right?
Yeah.
But that was something I was going to bring up at some point, was that the connection, the strange connection you have to our friend Matt Wilson, is that you're both in the moment. And sometimes, you know, in reviews, like humor drummer Matt Wilson, I'm like, yeah, but you're making it sound negative. Matt's an amazing guy, right?
Totally, totally. I love playing with Matt. I just played with him recently.
That's a Trio M, right?
Yeah. But I was doing a gig with this trumpet player and vocalist named Sarah Wilson, and Matt's on her record that's coming out right now. And so we did a CD release gig at Freight and Salvage in Berkeley just a month ago.
Wow.
And, you know, I haven't had the chance to play with hardly anyone the last year and a half, but
right.
I haven't played with Matt since before the pandemic. And we just haven't, and we have a very like immediate intuitive connection.
Yeah, there's some intuitive thing going on there that just impressed me, and it impressed me. Who cares if I'm impressed? But I just mean that I've known Matt, I mean, literally since Shusha Buster. I mean, since he met his wife Lisa, and then so like 35 years.
You know him from Boston.
I know him from Boston.
Okay.
And I don't know him from Illinois when he was there, but it's just one of those things when I can understand that somebody has this sort of, let's use the word metaphysical or non-physical or just like energetic connection or resonance with somebody that I know that well. Like, you and I have played together a few times, but it's not like we played together a million times. And I played with Matt Wilson a million times.
Right. I love that quartet with you guys.
Yeah, it's strange. It's like the quartet nobody remembers. It's very strange. But anyway, we're trying to fix that, right? We're going to talk about how great the Matt Wilson quartet was. Even though I'm in it, I'm going to talk about how great it was. Hey, Myra, we were talking about your, I think we put it at, or you put it, or I put it as your physical relationship to the piano. And obviously you don't really get to take your piano with you, right? At this point, you're not, is it Keith Jarrett or Chick Corea? One of those pianists would fly in their piano.
But yeah, I heard that about Keith Jarrett. But
Keith Jarrett, whatever.
But, not.
So what is that? I mean, how do you, I don't know. Just tell everybody what your relationship physically to the piano is and how you garner that relationship.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think really what I mean by that phrase, like my physical relationship to the piano, is just that I have a very physical relationship with the piano, in the sense that it involves my whole body. It's like all of me is playing the piano, and in a sense, you know, I guess I could say that the piano is an extension of me, or I'm somehow an extension of the piano or something. There's this relationship that feels very symbiotic is the right word, but you know, it's just, I don't know. All I can think of is corny ways to say it, like becoming one with the piano or something, but you know, And so it's not about a specific piano, obviously, because I have a really nice piano at home, but I don't play that when I'm touring. It's really just, there's something, and also the physical layout of the piano. I mean, I'm a small person. It's a big instrument. And I feel like all of me is involved in playing it. And I have, I think you even used the expression, something about dancing. You know, when I'm playing the piano, sometimes I just feel like I'm dancing and I happen to be making sound at the same time, you know? And for me, the first impulse that I feel is a physical one. I think other people might hear a sound and then play that sound. For me, I feel an impulse to make this physical gesture. It sounds like this. And so then that starts this feedback loop where the sound and the energy and the gesture then informs the next one and the next one. But it's not like, and sometimes it's very specific, like I'll hear, you know, I'll really be more in the forefront will be my awareness of the pitch material. But usually it's really more about how I feel like moving at the piano.
I'm all into the corny thing because I think that we can all relate to this kind of, dialogue. But one thing that really captured that for me was you and I played this week-long workshop masterclass at the University of Washington in Seattle. Do you remember doing that workshop?
Yeah, that was so much fun.
It was really fun. And I remember two things. I remember on the show before one of my songs, I was like, hey, Myra, do you want to play an intro? And we had not rehearsed that or anything. I'm like, yeah. And then you just play this amazing, just like in the moment. And this is obviously just my view of it, but it was just like this energetic moment. Like, okay, Myra just kicked our butts, man. She just played this incredible music that's better than my composition. Kung and I are like, Kung Vu, the trumpet player who actually got us on that show, was like, yeah, what are we going to do now? Because Myra just played the hell out of this song. I was like, yeah, I don't know. We'll just get through it.
I don't remember this.
Yeah, but you wouldn't, because that's what I'm talking about. You go to this place that's super, gosh, what do we say? Non-physical, or you're just in the moment. And like I said, I think you're dancing and you kind of agree with me on that. And Kung and I were like, what are we supposed to do? And I was like, I don't know. We'll just do what we do, which is read the chart and then play our solos, you know, and then get the hell out of here. But it was really beautiful.
Song. Yeah, that's beautiful. All that beautiful melodic material.
Yeah, I'm a melodic guy.
I love your music, Andrew.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And so you, I appreciate the compliment, Myra. You know, I know you mentioned that you were doing your sabbatical in Italy, and you have that home that somebody offered you. And do you have a project there? Are you doing some kind of musical project while you're there?
Yeah, I just have this, it's sort of in the very early stages, but I've always been really inspired by the artwork of Cy Twombly. And I guess for people who don't know him, he's an American artist who spent most of his career living and working in Italy, and kind of is thought of as a post-abstract expressionist, and a contemporary of Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns and, you know, people like this, but really was a total, his visual language was incredibly unique and not like other people before, during, or after, really. And whenever I see his, I've been really into his artwork, I guess since about 1994, when there was a big retrospective of his work at MoMA here in New York. And I remember reading about him at the time that he used to practice drawing when he was starting out as an art student by waiting until dark and then turning out all the lights and just getting into the physical gesture of making a line.
Interesting.
The physicality and the, you know, the, he was doing it till it felt good, until it felt right, rather than what it looked like. And that felt like a really, another way of talking about what I was just talking about at the piano, that it's really the physical aspect of it that I'm going for. And the sound is important, but it's not, that's not what's driving me in a sense. And so I've always felt this affinity with him, and I finally decided to just like really give into that. And, you know, when I see his artwork, I feel like responding through music. So I put together this big ensemble that's made up of a few different smaller groups that I play with. And I'm writing music, you know, specifically in relation to certain works of his. But I'm also traveling around to all the places he lived and worked and studied, both in the U.S. and in Europe, and making field recordings that I'm going to develop some sort of electronic, I don't know, either kind of an installation-like component to the work or like sort of electronic environments in which acoustic music then interacts or grows out of or leads into. So I'm, you know, I'm just really open at this point, but mostly what I'm learning is a lot more about him and his process, and, you know, comparing that to making music and what that feels like, and just it feels great to have a year to just really not have to have a specific, you know, the piece is going to be like this, but more like what happens if I follow up on all these things that intrigue me about his work.
I wonder if this is comparable to what you're talking about when he would turn off the lights or whatever at night and just get the energy of creating art. And what you're describing is, you know, when we first went into quarantine, I would do this thing. I mean, it's maybe midnight, maybe it's 2 a.m, and I'm looking at something on the internet or I'm just whatever I'm doing. And I would just hold my saxophone and I would play it, but I couldn't play because obviously it's late and you don't want to be like playing late at night, at least not in my neighborhood. And I was just doing this thing where I was feeling my instrument and feeling the music. And, you know, once, obviously, so many of us lost all of our tours and gigs and everything. Okay, that is what it is. And I don't even, lost is not the word. We had to wait. And then when it came time to play a show, you know, I was like, oh, are my lips going to hold up? How do I sound? But my instrument, I was just so, I don't know. It's weird. Am I making sense, Myra? It just yeah. felt like I felt very connected to it. Mm. And it wasn't... As Larry David likes to say, it really didn't take that long. Like I just got up on stage and I played and I was like, I'm totally connected to this, but it's weird. I never thought about it like that. I thought, oh, I better keep my fingers moving so I have my chops, right?
Right, right.
But maybe I was inadvertently, like, you know what I mean? Energetically,
yeah,
something with the instrument. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't play you right now, but it's late at night and I'm sorry, we're not on the road and we're not in Europe or whatever. And I would say, I love you to my saxophone. And then we just, I'd noodle around or whatever I was doing.
Yeah.
But is that kind of the same thing or am I totally off base here?
No, I can totally relate to that. It's, I mean, it sounds similar. It's, I don't know that I've actually done the same thing on the piano, but I have really thought about my connection to the instrument and kind of a ritualistic way to like nurture my connection to the instrument. And it's, to me, it sounds like that's what you're talking about, you know? And I think when we do that, and of course, like now with years of experience, you're also calling on that. But I think it's interesting that we are so obsessed with, and I do this all the time, oh my God, I'm not practicing, I'm not in shape.
Right, blah, right, blah, blah, blah. Right.
But I am. But if I like step back from that or step down a level from that, I'm still totally connected to my instrument. Right. And totally connected to the music, and the chops then be, you know, hopefully they're there and they probably are there or they're not, but it doesn't matter because, you know, there's this great poem by Rumi, Where Everything Is Music. You know that poem?
I don't.
He says, it doesn't matter if, let's see, how does it go again? Oh, well, anyway, the gist of it is, doesn't matter if our instruments are broken or if we've forgotten the music or whatever. We've fallen into a place where everything is music. And you'll have to see. I wish I had the poem here to share it on the thing. But it's just a really beautiful way of reminding us that this idea of performing and presenting this perfect thing is not really what's essential. You know?
Well, I mean, in the end, I mean, the reality is, and no offense to anybody who's listening or watching this interview, in the end, people don't necessarily care about that kind of stuff. I mean, there are people who do care about execution and things being perfect and things being like super, you know,
yeah,
like put together and all that stuff. But really, they just want to be entertained. They want to enjoy themselves. They want to feel an energy of, you know, joy or love, or even, you know, I mean, sometimes we want to feel sad. We want to listen to music that helps us understand that maybe our dad just passed away or our mom or whatever. Right.
Yeah.
And so we're like, yeah, I want to feel like shit. And so I want music that helps me there. And I want to feel happy. And does anybody care what, like, whether or not you played that scale perfectly, Myra, or what reed I'm using, or, you know, what drumsticks, you know, somebody's using, or what cymbals or bass strings? No, they just want to feel an energy, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree. I remember that line though. It's, don't worry about saving these songs. And even if our instruments are broken, it doesn't matter.
During our break, I had this memory about that same University of Washington. What was that? A residency? We were there for a week or something.
Yeah, it was
like
part
this.
Of the IMP Festival.
Right. I was like curious about the name IMP, like, but that's improv, right? I think that's what it means. And we had all spent, like, you had your ensemble, I had my ensemble. And for some reason, my ensemble came to the hotel. We were sitting out front we were drinking some wine and folks, everybody's 21 or over. We weren't like getting messed up. And Myra walks by and she goes, how's your second rehearsal going, Andrew? And I was like, it's going well.
I'm so impressed with how much, you know, it really brought home that thing, like for students to be able to hang out with musicians and just talk about music and talk about life. is just as valuable as whatever goes on in a rehearsal or a lesson, you know?
Right. Like, that's a B flat, man. Or that's a G sharp, man. Or like, you got to play the 5/4 better, right? Like just hanging out and just taking a, you know, a glass of wine or whatever. And you're like, you just kind of, and you turned and you went, how's the second rehearsal going, Andrew? I was like, it's going well. I just love that about you. I love you, Myra. And you knew what I was doing. You knew I was rehearsing them. You knew that was going to be part of the show that we did eventually at the end of the week or whatever it was, the 10 days or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. I'm crying a little bit. I'm laughing so hard. But so let's bring it home. Have you experienced in at all in your career any kind of sexism in the music business? Is there anything you want to say to that point? And if not, that's okay. It's up to you. I'm just curious.
You know, I have to say for many years, I didn't think about it very much. Like it wasn't on my radar. I was fortunate to move to New York and become part of a community of musicians that spanned generations and races and sexes or gender. I wasn't really very aware of it, but I did start to become more aware of it. So I was encouraged and I didn't feel like people, you know, that I had to prove something because I was a woman. But I did start to notice, you know, comments in reviews or interviews or whatever, where people would always talk about what I looked like, my physical appearance. And it suddenly occurred to me that I don't see them saying that about my male colleagues necessarily, you know.
Right.
They're not commenting on what they're wearing or how tall they are or how short
right.
they are.
Very handsome Andrew D'Angelo played right. a concert, right? I'm kidding, folks, but it's just like, right? But there's a qualifier. And I actually have a quote written down where it's like, whoever wrote the quote, who wasn't, what do you call that? It didn't say who wrote the quote, but it was like, fuck cares what Myra looks like. You know, she's Myra. She's an amazing musician. You don't need to talk about her hair or body, right? Or clothes, right?
So that kind of thing is sort of irritating. And then you start to realize, oh, you know, you can't escape this thing that happens in our society, which is to have assumptions or presumptions or judgments about people or expectations because of how they look or because of their sex or because of their race or, you know, and of course, I'm well aware of the history of, you know, unequal treatment for women and you know, the feminist waves to try to address that, which we're still going through. And now as a much older musician, I feel like it's very important to address these things. And I feel even more, you know, like how important it is to champion younger women musicians and to create opportunities that don't, you know, kind of say, well, this is a women's festival, even though those can be helpful. It's really more like this, you know, programming needs to have equal numbers of representation from all these different groups right. that make this music. And anyway, you know, there's a lot that still needs to be addressed. And I know a lot of women face a lot more overt sexism than I have. And that also needs to be addressed.
Right. And so when you say you weren't aware of any sexism in the business, does that mean it existed and you just weren't paying attention? Or does that mean that it wasn't there?
Well, it wasn't there. It's hard to know because, you know, I don't know whether it's a kind of naivety or just the fact that I really didn't experience it in any kind of overt way. But I think naive in the sense that I didn't expect people to treat me differently because I was a woman.
Right.
And I wasn't looking for that. And I rarely felt it. I mean, there were a couple times where I heard comments later, you know, about, oh, you know, she can really play for a woman or something like
that. Ah, geez. I'm sorry.
You know, that kind of stupid thing.
Right. Hey, you play good for a lady.
Yeah, right. A little lady.
Basically. Oh, my God. Crazy.
Yeah. But I think, you know, and money, I don't know. You know, it's hard. That's one of those things that's hard to know. Have I been paid less?
Right.
You know, it's not easy to make a living doing what we do anyway. So. But, you know, I'm sure that there was probably stuff going on that I wasn't aware of. But nobody told me I couldn't do what I wanted to do. Nobody said I'm not going to hire you or, or I expect a sexual favor. I didn't have to deal with that kind of thing.
Right. So, but also that kind of situation can be obtuse, overt, what's the word, where maybe a festival or something, you know, a jazz festival or whatever, doesn't hire you because you're a woman, but it's not like they're going to tell us, right?
Yes.
Like, Andrew, because you're gay, we're not going to hire your band, right?
Right.
Or Myra, because you're a woman, we're not going to hire you on our festival to be a headliner. It's not as if they would say that, but it might be part of the equation. We just don't know, right?
Exactly.
And I think I've had several, female musicians on the show who talk about it's more subtle, like they get ignored or they show up to the gig and they're like, oh, you must be the singer, right?
Uh-huh.
Or they say, oh, wow, nice outfit, that kind of thing. It's very subtle. Right. And I don't have that experience other than just talking to female musicians and or artists, and they're just general. I mean, even I had a female chef on the show and she was like, yeah, there's sexism all over the place. Right.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, one person I was talking to said, if somebody hired me for this festival because I have big tits, I would do the gig. I would take the money. Like, they didn't mind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was like, really? And they're like, yeah, I don't care. It's weird. I'm not making that up. That's a true story.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, so don't we all have, like, what do you call it? Like some kind of prejudice somewhere? And I'm not talking about race. I'm just talking about things that we like, things that we enjoy to look at.
Yeah.
And but that's one thing that I feel like you've transcended is your music is just transcendental. Okay, folks, I'm going to use that word. Myra's music is transcendental. It's beyond the physical. I don't know how anybody can describe it how they want. It can be Rumi. It can be Sufi. It can be chi energy, whatever it is. But I think you just have, at least since I've been aware of you for, which is 20 years, 25 years, something like that, just this ability to transcend. And I really love and I respect that and honor it a lot, very much.
That means so much to me, Andrew. Thank
Does
you.
Does it? Well, I don't know, because I'm here, like, we worked on, let's try to wrap this up, but we've been booking this interview for what, like, 6 years or something like that.
I thought it was only 6 months.
Right. All right. Myra's very difficult, everybody. No, I'm just kidding. And so I had the inclination to ask you to come on and so on and so forth. And I start listening to Snowy Egret, and you were doing it with Chris Speed, the tenor saxophonist. And it was that thing, the retrospective you did at the Stone in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is Chris came into town that day because they're selling the building next door. Chris Speed and I live next door. I think everybody knows that at this point, but he had to move out, and there he was. And I was cranking your music on my speakers with Chris Speed and you playing. I don't know who else is in that band. Was that Stone Moon?
Well, that was the Same River Twice, I think.
Oh yeah. Oh no. I totally forgot to talk about the Same River Twice. Wait, we have to talk about that. That's what led me to it. was that everybody knows that I'm an Ornette freak, and everybody's like, oh, you sound like Ornette Coleman. I'm like, fuck you. Yeah, I know I do. And I played with Ornette once briefly, so I had my chance. But Myra, to prove my point that you're into this non-physicalness and that metaphysical is the same river twice, where Ornette says you can't step into the same river twice because you're always getting what? Well, you explain it. I could read the quote, but you explain it.
Yeah, well, I've heard it translated a number of different ways. So basically, you can't step into the same river twice because new water is always flowing on you. The water, right. You know, it's never the same water.
I love that. And I mean, I think that to me, that I can't believe I totally forgot about that part of it. But that encapsulates you in my mind. Like, you never get the same Myra. You know what I mean? And that's... But I don't think we ever get the same anybody.
Right.
I mean, on my show, I try to keep some things consistent and, you know, I take breaks, you know, blah, blah, blah. But in the end, you're not getting the same me, but definitely Myra. I was like, oh yeah, you never get the same Myra and you never get the same Ornette, right? You never do. Even if we're playing, I don't know, pick a song, Stella by Starlight or something like this, or one of our songs, we're never getting the same person.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it's beautiful. So Myra, in conclusion, is there anything you would like to share with the world, or should we just like call it?
Jeez. I don't know. Maybe not. But, you know, I mean, just that I totally agree with you. That's why I love improvised music so much, because, you know, it can and does change all the time, and you're not playing the same thing, much as you might try. And then that meeting with that, that having to face that and grapple with that, or whatever it is, have a nice relationship with it is what's so special about it. It's always it's, you know, the unknown. If you can really approach it from that perspective.
Right. Who's that guitarist? He's since deceased and crossed over. Improvising guitarist, used to play at Tonic quite a bit and at the Knit. I all of a sudden I'm spacing out on his name. But he said, to truly play improvisationally, you cannot touch your instrument until it's time to improvise. Mm-hmm. What is that guy's name? And it is a guy, and he used to take naps during the set break because he said he was best when he first woke up. But
I can't think of who you're talking about.
I can't either. But I've always wanted to try a gig where I play kind of like a loop on my saxophone over and over for an hour. I don't know if I could do it, if I have the stamina or the energy, or I have the desire, where I'm just like playing the same lick over and over and over, because it's never going to be the same. Even like, so what is improvisation, I guess, is my question. Like, is that improv, or do we have to be doing something different every time? You know, I know I'm like totally going off on a tangent here, but it's just, there's just something, Myra, especially when I listen to you play solo, which I found something. I'm not going to look at my notes because I'm not in the mood. So I'm not going to remember what the name was. You were doing a solo concert, and their view was basically, yeah, Myra doesn't really need a band. She's like an entire orchestra. And I thought that was really cool. I was like, oh yeah, Myra is like an orchestra. I mean, you do, right? You have the percussion, you have the melody, you have the horns, you have the violins, you got the strings, you got everything in Myra Melford. And I'll put a link to that solo show. I'm sorry. I'm not. Okay. I'll look at my notes to see if I can find it. Ah, geez. You don't remember it?
No, I don't think I ever even saw that.
Yeah. It's one of those, I'm somebody from Europe and I love this musician and I'm going to post this video and I'm going to tell everybody how great they are. And because we respect these people who are making this music and making these creations. And they're like, yeah, Myra doesn't really need a band. She is the orchestra, is what he said.
Wow, that's cool. She goes, I haven't seen that.
Said she is orchestra, right? So translation thing there. She is orchestra, percussion, melody, strings, all of it, rhythm. all encapsulated. And I was like, yeah, that's pretty much sums up Meyer for me. Is that an okay? Is that okay? Is that bad? I don't think it's bad.
That's no, I think that's pretty cool. I'm honored.
I know. And imagine, you know, if we could go on tour solo, then we wouldn't have to like tour with the whole band. We could just like, you know, play alone. All right.
Yes.
All right, Myra, thank you for being here. And I appreciate your time and enjoy New York while you're here. And please stay in touch and enjoy Italy while you're there for a year. Well, that's going to be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
All right.
I'm excited.
Take care of yourself.
You too.
Take care. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Constant Constance. Tune in every week for new conversations. And if you want even more, check out Andrew's Patreon for more exclusive content and additional conversations. Hosted and produced by Andrew D'Angelo. Edited and mixed by Lucy Little. Original music by Andrew D'Angelo and Maximilian Moore D'Angelo. Intro is Henrietta Weeks. Thanks so much. See you next time.
You fucking beautiful. Yeah, you fucking rocked it. Like, you she doesn't it. She doesn't know she says podcast, right? Like, she doesn't even